We do have breaking news. President Trump ordering military strikes in Syria. The U.S. firing 59 cruise missiles at a Syrian airbase. These strikes are in retaliation for President Assad's chemical weapons attack on his own people that killed dozens, including children.
The missiles flew. The explosives exploded. The nation was again at the cusp of war, and the media were again at peace.
No doubt what they wanted to do with the strikes is not only send a signal to Assad, but really to the world that there's a new sheriff in town, that they're going to take a tougher line, that this isn't a president that's going to be reluctant to use military force.
Donald Trump became president of the United States.
That was CNN's Fareed Zakaria expressing the overwhelming consensus. Something had to be done about Assad. Trump did it. Moral and political justice had been served. Emphatically, even poetically.
We see these beautiful pictures at night from the decks of these two U.S. Navy vessels in the Eastern Mediterranean. I am tempted to quote the great Leonard Cohen, "I'm guided by the beauty of our weapons."
That was MSNBC's Brian Williams, in awe of the spectacle that begins in a fireworks show and ends in death. To me, that's just a little too Apocalypse Now.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
Apocalypse Now, of course, was a savage satire of brutality, moral obtuseness, and imperialism, whereas the news is supposed to inform and contextualize events, not romanticize them. But we've been here before.
America strikes back. Afghanistan is pounded with bombs and missiles from the air and sea.
We are supported by the collective will of the world.
The commander of the U.S. Army's 3rd Infantry Division's 1st Brigade Combat Team says the first day of the ground war, in his words, couldn't have gone better. From the Iraq-Kuwait border to the edge of the Euphrates River Valley in less than 6 hours.
General Westmoreland says the Americans are responding with the greatest concentration of conventional firepower in history. The U.S. artillery fire is 10 times greater than the enemy's.
How can it be that when we most need skeptical media, they so often fall into formation and march to the official line? This isn't a question about whether this or any other military action is correct and righteous. It may well be that the Syria missile attack was just the right proportionate response to butchery. The question is, how is the public supposed to evaluate its government's actions when the media sound like an NFL broadcast booth?
Oh, that's a catch. My God, that's incredible. That's amazing concentration by...
The fascination and excitement not only turn life and death matters into cheap titillation, they seem to trigger amnesia of Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, and other military adventures that commenced so dramatically in the name of freedom, democracy, human rights, and our own national security, but wound up hundreds of thousands of deaths later, trillions of dollars later, in chaos. It is understandable, of course, to support our fighting men and women in harm's way, but in the last 25 years, this has mutated from support our troops to support our military to God bless America the moment a shot is fired, whereupon otherwise level-headed commentators say, this is the moment when Donald Trump became president. No, that was in January. This was just the moment when Donald Trump got the media enemy to suspend disbelief. If ever there were a time not to blindly defer or to even uncritically pass along the government narrative, it is when the smell of ordnance is in the air. In the name of national cohesion, it at least used to be said, politics ends at the water's edge. Journalism does not. To look at the coverage of the missile strikes was to be struck by the simplicity of the question. Not a Gordian knot of geopolitics, regional politics, domestic politics, and the proliferation of terror, but the stark choice between good and evil. Is it that easy, though? Stephen Kinzer, senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University and a columnist at the Boston Globe, says the public is being sold dangerous reductivism by the government and the media.
It's the perfect expression of the American view of the world, comes from our Calvinist roots. That teaches us, first of all, that there's good, that's us, and then there's evil, that's out there. We love the binary narrative. Then we know who to hate, everything becomes easy. Now, I don't mind that it becomes the political narrative. I don't like it, but I understand it. What I find distressing is that the press jumps onto this also.
Without making a UN presentation, tell me why this tangle is actually not binary, but a Gordian knot.
We have to look at the realistic alternatives. If Assad is gone from power in Syria, the most likely thing is that at least a large part of Syria is going to be run by ISIS or al-Qaeda. Now, is that better? Have we gotten somewhere? Is that positive? I would argue that Americans use the wrong standard when deciding about interventions like this. When situations are awful somewhere, we decide we have to intervene. But the real question should be, what will be accomplished by our intervention? Are we actually going to get anything positive out of it? That's a question that we don't hear asked very often.
Indeed, from your point of view, the U.S. news coverage of the missile attack was not just a consensus of approval, but very nearly unanimous. Why?
I think the evidence naturally is part of the reason, but that's not enough for the whole reason. The real reason is that this is what we were told by our government leaders. The press jumps onto this narrative, just as we've jumped onto the government's narrative about Iran and about Russia, and then actually intensified them. In many cases, we have leading American newspapers that are more warlike, more belligerent than even the Pentagon is. So rather than performing the role that the press is supposed to play, which is to ask questions and to look under the rug and to see if there's not an alternative explanation, the press is doing the opposite. It's embracing the narrative that's being handed out by power and repeating it unquestioning.
All right. If you were the Sultan of media, what questions would you be asking from the government and to do your duty to your audience?
On Syria, the first question I would ask is, what do you see as a good solution choosing among realistic options? On Russia, I would ask, how would the United States react if Russia was behaving in our immediate neighborhood the way we are behaving in Russia's immediate neighborhood?
All right. It's very easy, and we have seen it a lot, for this kind of behavior to be dismissed as the corporate media just toadying up to the government as usual. It's a little more complex, isn't it?
It's not true that the government can tell the press what to write, but it is true that the government sets the agenda of what to write about. If the president's not talking about something and it's not a subject in Congress, it's not important. So right now, we're hearing this narrative, everybody needs to focus on the evils in Syria and the horrific atrocities perpetrated by Assad. We jump onto that narrative and decide that's what we have to focus on. So much of our reporting about these crises, and Syria in particular, is coming from Washington. There aren't independent sources of news in much of Syria. So when you read a story about Syria, it's usually written by someone in Washington who has covered all of his bases. He's covered the State Department, the Defense Department. He called Capitol Hill. He called somebody in a think tank. And then he thinks he talks to everybody on every side. In fact, he's only gotten four versions of the same truth.
On a more practical level, there's, you know, also the issue of resources and expertise. You know, so few foreign bureaus, so few foreign correspondents, so many fewer reporters, even among the head nodders in Washington.
It's true. There was a time when I was a foreign correspondent for the New York Times that you could go off for 2 weeks to some distant country and take a photographer and just investigate what was happening. Papers don't have the resources for that anymore. That's why so much foreign news comes out of Washington. So I understand the resource problem, but what I don't like is that we never present this resource problem to our readers. We try to pretend that we still know as much as we would know if we were covering the story honestly. Instead, we have covered the story from one single angle and quoted all these sources who pretend to know what's really going on in parts of Syria, which are actually under control of ISIS, where anybody who reports anything other than the ISIS narrative is going to be killed. The situation for reporting from Syria was particularly graphic during the long period when bombing of Aleppo was underway. We kept getting reports from inside the besieged area talking about the barrel bombs and the brutality and the suffering. And these would be picked up by a couple of freelance operators who billed themselves as human rights activists. The fact is that those regions that were under siege were controlled by ISIS and Al-Qaeda. There wasn't any way for any news to come out that was not specifically vetted by them. I understand that, but I don't understand why the American press would then effectively become the reproducer of ISIS propaganda. That's what we did during the siege of Aleppo, and that has shaped the perceptions of Americans about Syria, about this war, and about President Assad.
But, you know, I wonder if there's not something deeper. There's this reflex in the press, whenever shots are fired, toward jingoism, the conflation of support for our troops with the uncritical support of any war they're sent to fight.
We have a president who's thirsty for applause and approval. He hasn't gotten much, but he did get a huge amount by bombing another country. It's definitely true that Americans are very vulnerable to the rally around the flag effect. Bombing another country always makes presidents popular, at least in the short run. It plays off of a greater narrative that Americans are fed in large part from the press, and that is, we are in imminent danger. We have threats all around us. We have to fight them abroad so they don't come to our homeland. In fact, the opposite is true. The United States is not only the safest big power in the world, we're safer than any big power has ever been in the history of the world. But the press, realizing that selling the narrative that there's no big danger is not going to make people go out and consume news, eagerly feeds into this idea that there are dangers all around us. The Syria situation is just a subset of that larger narrative.
All right. At the risk of looking at everything through the prism of domestic politics, I have to ask you about the wag the dog scenario. The president has historically low approval ratings at this stage of an administration. His domestic endeavors have so far amounted to total belly flops. And there seems to be disarray in his own White House. Nothing to get public opinion on your side like bombing a foreign country.
In America, if you haven't killed people and you haven't bombed a country, you're not really a legitimate president yet. There's no doubt that his political advisors must have realized that this is going to win you applause across partisan lines, and that's exactly what happened. The alternative would have been for Trump to show himself as the transformative, outside-the-box figure that he sometimes portrayed himself as being back in the campaign days. Then he could have said, I hated what Assad seems to have done, but what's going to be the effect of our intervention? Are we actually going to be able to change any outcomes by bombing someone? What do we get out of this? What's the larger project? And maybe this is the moment when we begin to withdraw from our involvement in the extended Middle East civil war, which is going to go on for decades. He could have broken with consensus. It probably would have brought him a great deal of criticism, but criticism from exactly the swamp that he had pledged to drain. Instead, he is loving the applause that is emerging from that very swamp.
All right. Now, I'm telling you that Twitter will blow up with accusations that you are an apologist for dictators and that what you're articulating is a kind of impunity for the most inhumane behavior by brutes, to which you reply.
Diplomacy is not about affection. Diplomacy is all about advancing your own national interest. You don't want to demonize people or even make people into heroes. It doesn't matter whether you like the leaders or the regimes. We are Americans. We are supposed to be promoting the national interest of the United States. So diplomacy is the way to do that, not through war. Our increasing involvement in Syria is not doing anything to our security except weaken it. To believe that Assad remaining in power is the least bad of awful options is not to support Assad.
I must ask you, do you have any reason to be skeptical of the central claim here, which is that Assad used sarin and other nerve agents to attack civilians? Is that in doubt?
I don't have any more information than anyone else. The military has presented evidence to President Trump, so I'm told, that's more persuasive than the evidence that we've seen in public. I just feel there should be a more open debate and there shouldn't be a death penalty for anyone who questions this. I haven't seen any evidence that it was anyone else. It doesn't seem logical that Assad would have done this, but people do things that are illogical in war. So let's just open it up and try to discuss this in a rational way without assuming that every conclusion that comes out of the Pentagon has to be accepted at face value.
Stephen, thank you so much.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Stephen Kinzer is a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University and a columnist at the Boston Globe. Thanks for listening to this podcast extra. If you're new to OTM, you should know that we put out two podcasts a week, a shorter one midweek, and then a full hour on Fridays. We also have an excellent weekly newsletter that you can sign up for on our website, onthemedia.org. And of course, you can and should follow us on Twitter and Facebook. I'm Bob Garfield.